New every Tuesday to Podcast One, Shenanigans with Sheena Shea from Vanderpump Rules.
Now I'm living in a new city.
Yeah.
I'm hanging with a new group of people. I have a new job. I'm in a different life.
Mm-hmm.
But watching back my old life from last year and my old apartment with my old boyfriend, like, it just started to get to where I'm like, I'm very happy in Vegas. And I know I say I'm happy. I always say
Sheena,
that the people don't even believe me anymore. But
you're like the girl who cried happy instead of the boy who cried wolf.
To hear more Shenanigans with Sheena Shea, subscribe exclusively on Apple Podcasts, PodcastOne.com, and the new Podcast One app. Don't forget to rate, review, and leave a 5-star rating.
And welcome to the Dr. Drew Podcast. Remember to check out the Swingin' Sounds. Support the people that support the podcast. Keep the winds in the sail, the Corolla Pilot Ship. Guys at Dr.com, the Hydrolite guys and the Bergamot guys are all guys I can stand by. And I strongly recommend the Hydrolite, something I wanted to invent myself. And now we've got it. So we're standing behind them. And check out the family of pods there. We've got the opioid chronicle there. We really go all the way back into prehistory and bring you forward with how the opiate problem developed and, you know, how we got where we are. And a lot of people do not know that story. It's very involved, very complicated, and it's not what you think it is. It's not just Purdue Pharma. Though they were duplicitous, there is a much, much bigger story. And yeah, check out the family pods, the YouTube page, the Facebook page. And I want to get right to my guest, Dr. Perry Goetze. She is a gynecologist, obstetrician. You can follow her at Perry_MD. Perry, right?
Yeah, I was
it's Perry. P-A-R-I _MD. Instagram at Dr. Perry, and also the website is DOC, Dr. Spelled Out, Perry.com. Welcome. Thank you for joining me. This is going to be interesting.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, and you're doing hospitalist work right now?
I am, yes.
And?
And I really much enjoy it. I was in private practice for 5 years, and now I am a OB hospitalist. So I do 24-hour shifts and delivering a lot of babies, seeing people in the ER.
So the American Society of Addiction Medicine puts out a journal, and they had a lead article that included a topic that I've been yelling about for quite some time, which is the myth of the opiate-addicted baby.
Mm.
The myth that somehow that baby is going to become a drug addict or somehow that outcome of that – and let me see if this is fits your experience or your training, which is my training, opiate addiction impaired the pregnancy and imperiled the pregnancy. And we used to put people on methadone and that straightened it all out. The babies would be addicted routinely,
mm-hmm.
and they would have 2 weeks of diarrhea, and that would be that.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be over, and they would have no higher incidence of anything else than any other baby with a mom with a history of addiction. Even if the mom has an alcoholic at age 50, it was about the same risk of that child developing addiction. Any other issues with the – provided that the pregnancy went well?
I think you're correct, you know, providing that the pregnancy went well.
Yeah.
And also, you have to also – it's not opioids, yes, but then, you know, when it's –
we're talking about opioids because
yeah.
unfortunately that is now adding to stigma.
Mm.
So people are being stigmatized for being opioid addicted during pregnancy. They're getting fearful that they're hurting their babies. And, you know, we have the first lady saying, oh, my whole thing is the babies. The babies are fine provided the pregnancy goes well. And if they come in and get proper care, it's not that hard to treat them during the pregnancy.
Right.
Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah. So, all this stuff about addicted babies makes me insane. But stimulants, a problem for
exactly.
sure. I'm with you on that.
Mm-hmm.
Although even those babies, we had a much greater concern about that back in the 90s. We would see a lot of neuro physiological problems. But the kids would all catch up by first grade.
Yeah.
By first grade, they pretty much catch up almost all the time.
Right. I mean, there's also all the studies, though, about like long-term behavioral differences and things like that, which
they haven't yet been able to parse that out from just having a mom who's a drug addict. And
right,
The ADHD associated with trauma, which is another, you know, little discussed factor in ADHD and ADD.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So what is keeping you up at night now? What are you worrying about in your patients?
I mean, tons of things, right?
Yeah.
I really, you know, like why I'm here today is to talk about HPV vaccine. That just keeps me up at night in terms of just so many myths that are out there. All the young women that I see that just have misconceptions of it, parents that have misconceptions of it in regards to vaccinating their children. So that's something that I, you know, am really passionate about talking about and wanting to talk about today.
Yeah, I was vilified for years coming out in favor of that. It wasn't even the anti-vaxxers. It was some other group got behind it saying, oh, it's going to cause neurological problems, all this stuff. It is the safest, has the safest profile of any vaccine in history.
Mm-hmm.
And it's deployed internationally, mandated in most countries, mm-hmm. because it prevents cancer.
Exactly.
It's the most bizarre thing in the world. Do you want people to get cancer? It has almost zero adverse effects.
Exactly. And it blows my mind, first of all, like how there's this big misconception of all the side effects. When you look at the side effects, it's so minimal. It's the same as having any other shot. Redness at the site, maybe a little bit of inflammation.
It's like
B12,
like a B12 injection.
Oh, which people are lining up to do.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
But then we have a vaccine that can actually prevent cancer.
Prevents cancer, 20,000 deaths. What is the matter with us as a country? It's bizarre. And then I had a crazy experience where we give it at age 9 to 12, and by men and women, males and women. And by the way, I believe if people are over the age of 28, which is the recommended age is, what, 8
26,
to 28?
26.
Now.
Yeah.
If you're over 40 and you're sexually active, find an enlightened doctor. There's no reason you can't take it. It's the FDA. They spent the money to approve it in the window, and it's most likely to be efficacious. If I were a 50-year-old sexually active dude with more than one partner, I would take the vaccine.
Yeah,
no
same.
Doubt in my mind.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, in other countries like Australia, for instance, they recommended up to 45 because that's when they did their studies.
Yeah.
So I always tell people if you, you know, are past that age, you're still sexually active, or you even have the interest in getting it because you think maybe sometime later in your life you may become sexually active again, get it.
Yeah.
The only problem is you're going to have to pay out of pocket for it.
But how much is it out of pocket?
I think it's around $600 usually.
For both the series?
Yeah, the whole thing, total.
It's a three-part. It's a three-year?
Well, the most recent one's now two parts.
Two parts, okay.
Yeah, two parts.
And then the crazy story I was going to tell you is that it's recommended for, you know, sort of pre-teenage because that's when it is most efficacious.
Mm-hmm.
That's why it's recommended for that age group. It's not recommended because we expect your child to go out and have sex or that they will go out and be wildly sexually active because they had a goddamn vaccine. But I had a pediatrician look at me in the eye and go, we're making it too easy for them today.
Oh, my
gosh. It's a pediatrician.
Gosh.
I was shocked. But when the pediatricians told me that my kids could have vaccines, I gave it to them myself. I couldn't give it to them fast enough.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's one of the things that really irks me is this idea that it's going to increase sexual activity or cause someone to have sexual activity
at
a younger age.
Zero evidence.
There's zero evidence. They've been doing studies now. There's been studies that have come out in the American Pediatric Association this past year saying that they've looked at it and it does not at all increase, you know,
look, if you want to follow that logic, hepatitis B is a sexually transmitted disease. Your child gets hepatitis B vaccine at age one.
Right.
Does that mean they're going to start having earlier sexual activity? It's the most bizarre logic on earth.
Yeah,
and the kids don't know what vaccines they're going to get. It's the parents' decision.
I used to always joke. I was like, it's not an aphrodisiac. It's a vaccine.
Oh, my God. It makes me crazy. But you're probably too young to have fought it out when it really was bad.
Mm-hmm.
It was just the most. That I remember that and the emergency contraceptive were the two things, two battles I had for a decade. And people refused to. Because we're doing such a bad job of educating people on science and particularly biology. They don't even know what they're talking about.
Right.
So they can have all these fantasies about it.
Right. Well, and now everyone, you know, I hate to say it, but becomes an expert with just a little bit of information that they read on the internet from a friend or, you know, it's people, you're right. It's like they're not basing it on science. And if you go back to the science will tell you what's correct.
That's it. We're objective. We're just, what are the facts?
What's the evidence?
What's the evidence? That's it. So, yes, I'm with you completely with the HPV vaccine. It makes me – and if you're within the age categories for which it is formally recommended in this country, insurance pays for it, right?
Exactly, yeah. Insurance pays for it.
Yeah. Anything commonly you're seeing these days on the gynecology or obstetrical front? Any sort of trends that we should be aware of or
– good question.
Yeah.
I think, you know, unfortunately I don't know if you've heard about this, but there's a rise in syphilis.
Yeah.
Which we haven't seen for years and years and years.
It comes and goes.
I mean, for me, it's new. Yeah. I guess I haven't been around long enough to where I've seen the trend up again. Yeah. For me, it was something that was laying pretty dormant for a long time. Yeah. So that's been something that's been interesting to see. And we're, you know, now going back to testing it in all pregnant women, which we weren't necessarily before. So
God, I remember a day back when I was first trained, everyone that was admitted to a hospital got a VDRL.
So we don't do it as often. So that's been interesting to kind of see that rise and take note of that. Gynecology-wise, I always am reading about some trend in the news or magazine of something to do weird to your vagina.
Some reconstruction or
something. Yeah, reconstruction, or also these little things like, oh, this month we're going to put glitter in it, or we're going to, I mean, weird things. Yeah,
bedazzle.
There's always a celebrity that's promoting something to do with your vagina or put an egg in it. It sounds silly, but that is what I'm always seeing. And every month I'm like trying to fight against that. I'm like, please don't do that.
How about in terms of surgical contraception? Are you guys doing much that way these days?
In terms of like tying your tubes and stuff? Yeah. We still do that pretty routinely. In more recent years, there's been something where it's surgical, but it's office-based, where you can go in with what is called a hysteroscope, where you go in through your cervix and then plug it through the tubes that way. That's a good way of permanently doing it. But, you know, like I'm actually a big proponent for longer term contraception, like IUDs or the implant that goes in your arm, because people don't realize it, but those are actually more effective than tying your tubes permanently when they're done correctly and they're reversible.
You know, one of the criticisms I've had of gynecologists over the years is they were very enthusiastic about the progesterone contraceptives, particularly what was the shot called? I mean, I can't remember what it was.
Depo-Provera.
And the very low dose estrogens and the high potency progesterones, and the effect it had on women's mood and libido. Mm. They were not discussing it at all with women, and I was seeing just tons of women with depression, irritability, sleep disturbances, and no sex drive.
Hmm. Yeah.
There's a certain population who have an increase in their sex
drive. Exactly. That's the thing.
But no one discussed with them any of these possibilities.
Yeah. That's something that you always have to discuss with patients when it comes to hormones is, you know, you don't know exactly how it's going to affect you. And so you just kind of have to try and take note of it, but always report back. You know, I always, tell my patients, if we start something new, make an appointment with me in another month or 2 months, and then let's just see how it's going for you.
Gary, I did that. Remember that Andrew Goldstein I did way long ago? He's a gynecologist.
I know him. Yeah. I went to GW for residency, and
that's where he practices.
He practices out there. Yeah.
And he has this way of assessing essentially the length of the estrogen receptor, and certain ones are more prone to being sort of suppressed or reabsorbed by progesterone stimulation. Mm-hmm. And it's those women that we're getting. So you can measure something to determine who's the one likely to get the suppression of libido. And a certain percentage of the women he was noticing, it's podcast episode 7 and 39 under the podcast1.com/premium. It was one of the early podcasts I did with him. And he was saying a significant percentage have permanent libido alterations with this shorter estrogen receptor.
Yeah, I've read about some of that and its effect as well on lubrication, the vagina, and all of
so
that.
So it just I wish gynecologists would discuss that more regularly, routinely with their patients, because they call me and call here, and I'm like, oh.
Right. Yeah, there's a lot of factors that are playing a role. And that's what's unfortunate is a lot of times they call in because they're thinking it's psychological or they think it's relationship-oriented.
They always do an inventory on themselves.
Right,
and the last thing they think of is the pharmacology, which is they should always think of that first.
Right. Go ahead.
Especially,
sorry.
Please.
I was just saying, especially if not just, you know, birth control, but if there's been any sort of medication that's been introduced, you know, and you're having a change in your sexual function or libido, you should look at that.
And I would argue as an intern, you know, I spent, you know, many years evaluating patients. I was doing medical evaluations in a psychiatric hospital. Any medical or whatever untoward effect you're having, I promise you it's the medicine. I mean, 95% it's the medicine. If you're on a medicine and something happens to you, think medicine first.
Right.
Always. Especially if you're on a high dose of something or a moderate dose of something. I'm looking at questions up there. I think we're going to try to stay with medical calls there, Gary. I'm going to talk about McCarthyism, if you don't mind. Let's talk about an interpersonal problem. Maybe you made stuff you may deal with in your practice a little bit. Drew from Kentucky, go ahead there. Hey. Maybe I've got the wrong line up. Drew, there you are.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Yeah, there we go. Okay, yeah, thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I've been married for almost 17 years. There's been no infidelity, no physical abuse. I did have a drinking problem last summer. My wife just recently filed for divorce, and we have three children. Mm-hmm. And we were very, you know, amicable just before she filed. But this has been about 8 weeks ago, and we've not had a conversation since. She asked for a mutual restraining order, and we cannot even have a conversation. Of course, I want to, and I want to work things out.
What's your question for us?
How do you have any advice on how to work things out when we cannot even communicate?
We are missing information here. There's more to be revealed than you evidently know, and I'm not sure what it is. Either your perceptions of your minor little drinking problem last summer is perhaps a minimization of what actually happened, or maybe maybe some behaviors developed during that time or since that really bothered her more than you knew, or maybe there's somebody else that you – again, there's something missing. Her experience is not being properly represented here, and you need to find out what her experience has been that motivated all this. I'm sorry that she won't talk to you. Who's got the kids?
Well, we've got joint standard, and so we just swap them back and forth, unfortunately.
But you don't talk to her at all during those swaps?
Not at all. We're not even allowed to speak face-to-face.
Yeah, I'm sorry. You must deal with a lot of interpersonal stuff, too. I know you're mostly a hospitalist, but any advice for him?
Well, I was just going to ask if there was any sort of third party that's facilitating anything with you guys, whether it be a therapist or someone who's overhanding custody, if they had any insight for you.
Unfortunately, it's just lawyers. I have tried to get therapists involved, but she has refused, and so it's just the legal system right now. So there's no real advice other than just legal advice, yeah.
I'm sorry, Drew. There's just something missing here, and you deserve an explanation, I would say. And I'm sorry that whenever our families are broken up and the kids are involved, it's – you know, they've started to include divorce and single parent in the adverse childhood experiences scale. So it measurably affects the development of the children. And people need to be aware. They need to be thinking about that when they make big decisions like this. I'm looking at some calls. These are all sort of – oh, boy. Okay. I'm going to wait on these a few minutes. Surgically, are you spending most of your time just obstetrically? Or are there other surgeries of infections? What kinds of stuff are you having to do surgeries for typically? Tumors?
Well, yeah. When I'm in the hospital, it's things that are coming through the ER. So it's sometimes like ovarian torsion, which for people that don't know, that's when you get a large ovarian cyst. It twists on itself and then you start to lose blood supply to that ovary. That's one thing. Or big ruptured ovarian cysts we see, unfortunately, miscarriages.
Do you operate on ruptured cysts?
Yeah, sometimes. It depends. Okay. Most of the time you don't because it's something that'll just resolve on its own. I tell people, you know, go home, take Advil.
I'm stunned how often they used to do operations on the ovarian cyst. That was bizarre.
No, we try not to. With that said, like for instance, this past week, I had a patient we did have to operate on, and that's only because it had ruptured and it was bleeding. And then we could see that she was bleeding internally. Her blood count was dropping. Okay. So that's someone that you're going to obviously have to take to the operating room. Yeah. So sometimes those show up.
And you said it was, you know, sort of isolated cysts, simple cysts. It makes me think also about polycystic ovarian syndrome. There's a lot of ink being spilled on that these days. Anything new going on there?
Well, I think, you know, it's always been a good topic of mine to talk about only because I feel like it has become something that is a, quote, trash can diagnosis where
– Don't say trash can. I said that once. I had somebody I had somebody call in here. They don't know – people don't know what you mean.
Okay,
They think you mean that we're calling PCOS a trash can diagnosis. Okay. What we're saying is – when doctors begin to throw things into the trash can, they're very likely to throw that diagnosis into the trash can. Not because it's not a serious disease, not because it doesn't cause all kinds of disability and pain. It's the doctor behavior we're talking about. I had a call with a guy, and he goes, well, my girlfriend, she's got interstitial cystitis and endometriosis and polycystic ovaries. And he named like four different diagnoses. I go, look, instead of all these trash can diagnoses, why don't you also ask whether there's been some sexual trauma? Yes, I was sexually abused. Okay, well, maybe somebody ought to look there. You called endometriosis a trash can diagnosis. I to this day, that was probably 6 years ago, I still hear about it.
Well, thank you. So don't thank you, Dr. Drew, for
it's doctors throwing that into a trash can because they don't know what to put in the trash can. So they'll grab for PCOS and throw it in the trash can.
Exactly. So that's what I'm trying to say is that a lot of times when people have symptoms that are similar, for instance, they're just not having a cycle. Then they get really quickly diagnosed as, oh, you're PCOS.
Do they do it by ultrasound? Do they just
You know, sometimes I've seen so many patients that have come to me that said, I'm PCOS. And then I look at what the diagnostic criteria was and they just weren't meeting it.
What are the criteria usually?
So it's going to be missing periods or less periods, an increase of testosterone, either physically where you're having like hair growth or you see it in the blood work.
What is there a number there on that?
That's such a broad It's range. Just above what the normal range is for a female. I can't remember the number exactly right now. And then and or seeing what looks to be polycystic ovaries on an ultrasound. And you need two out of three of those criteria. And a lot of times what you'll see is someone come in that just wasn't having periods and someone will just say, oh, you're PCOS.
That's crazy.
It happens all the time.
It used to be ultrasound and multiple same size cysts.
Right.
Because you can have multiple cysts that are luteal cysts.
Exactly. It's a very classic appearance.
Yeah.
You know, where it's like a grapes basically going around. The ovary. It's not even someone who just makes a lot of cysts. A lot of times people are confused with that too. They're like, oh, I have a cyst every month.
No.
I'm PCOS.
No,
it's
no,
like, no, that's not how it works.
So it's over. That's what I thought. It was being overdiagnosed.
It definitely
Or anybody
is.
That has pelvic pain that's unexplained, they'll sort of throw that in the garbage bag. The doctor throws it in the garbage bag, not because it's a garbage bag diagnosis.
Exactly. So that's one that, you know, I feel like definitely gets overdiagnosed. And there's a lot of other reasons why people are, you know, missing their cycle, and it needs to be investigated. Questions need to be asked. All the laboratory tests need to be performed as opposed to just labeling somebody.
These days, opiates have got to be figured in there very prominently. Or even pot can do that.
Right.
Yeah. Anything that affects the endorphin system can affect the dopamine release in the pituitary.
And it's important for long-term implications too, because people that have PCOS, they do suffer from infertility. They're at increased risk for miscarriage. They're increased risk for diabetes later in their life, also during pregnancy. So if you get that label, it really has a lot of implications. So you want to make sure that the diagnosis is correct.
How about the use of treatment for insulin resistance with PCOS? Because I've seen people like thin women who were athletic and healthy being put on
metformin and stuff. It does work, though, actually, if you truly are PCOS, even if you're thin. And that's actually one of the misconceptions.
And it works for what?
So the whole process does work with insulin receptors. That's what's throwing off the hormones on the ovaries. It does help. And that's one of the misconceptions is that if you're skinny, you can't be PCOS. And that's not true.
No, I've definitely seen skinny PCOS. Right. But I always wonder why they were putting the thin PCOS patients on metformin and then telling them it's because of insulin resistance, not explaining the insulin resistance is affecting the ovarian cyst.
Right. Yeah.
Crazy.
It's interesting stuff. And so actually that's one of the fertility treatments for it is if you have PCOS and you're having trouble getting pregnant, metformin, there have been many, many studies that have helped with fertility even if you're not using classic fertility drugs.
Do you have a favorite treatment for endometriosis now?
I mean, I think still first line, I just go straight to birth control, just first line because it's the easiest, it's the lowest side effect. And I think that's what's most important is that you kind of start with medications that have the lowest side effect and move up, leaving surgery as a last case scenario. I hate to see when young people have endometriosis and they've been operated on 20 times.
I just always think, oh, sexual trauma.
Are
gynecologists asking that question these days?
I always do. I always think when people have pelvic pain, chronic pelvic pain,
unexplained.
Yes. That's the first thing that comes to my mind.
Yeah.
Do you
know, there's a whole theoretical framework now for how that happens with the pain is from several sort of in the Alan Shore and Peter Fonagy world where it's essentially what's called somatoform dissociation. Just when trauma, we also dissociate from our feelings. Mm-hmm. We can dissociate from the body in such a way that information coming out of whatever the traumatized reason was, is disorganized and overwhelming and hits up in the insular cortex, triggering misery, even though the somatic component may be just a confused bundle. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. Yeah. It's fascinating.
Yeah, it's very, very interesting.
When you're looking to buy a car, you want to make sure you're getting real pricing on actual inventory. A lot of times that is not the case. People configure cars online only later to find out they are not available. Not with TrueCar. Of course, I'm talking about TrueCar. You get real pricing on actual inventory. This is not pricing offered by TrueCar, but pricing from an actual dealer. And not just any dealer, but a TrueCar certified dealer. This is a carefully curated network of dealers committed to transparency and offering you a competitive market price. Yeah, you know, and we talk about all the time. Using TrueCar, you can easily find the car you want. Next, TrueCar, TrueCar.com or TrueCar app will show you what other people in your area paid for the same car you're looking for. Now you know at a fair price, so you can feel confident. Over 3 million cars have been sold to TrueCar users by the TrueCar Certified Dealer Network. Over 3,000 TrueCar Certified Dealers are available nationwide. You will get to work directly with a TrueCar Certified Dealer that you make contact with, and TrueCar users are more likely to enjoy a faster, better buying experience when they contact a TrueCar Certified Dealer. And on average, you can expect to save over $3,000 off MSRP. Once you register, you'll see a real price on actual inventory. Hook up with that TrueCar certified dealer. Have a better buying experience. TrueCar, go to the TrueCar.com or TrueCar app. Do what I'm telling you.
Let me take another call here. This is something you can probably help me with, too. Angie?
Angie.
Angie, there you are. It looks like an L up there. I almost said angle. What's going on?
Hi. So hey. I'm 43 years old. My question is about getting off Zoloft. Mm. I'm 43 years old. I had my first baby last year, 9 months ago, so I was 42. And I suffered from postpartum depression, but mainly DMER, so dysphoric milk ejection reflex, because I'm breastfeeding.
Oh, my gosh. Tell us about that. That's fascinating.
Oh, it was the worst. It was the worst thing I've ever, like, been through in my life.
Explain.
Many of my family members suffer from depression. I kind of know what that's like. I personally have never suffered from depression. But so what would happen was when my milk would let down for about 15 seconds, I would just feel the greatest sense of doom I've ever felt in my life. Like, I felt like the world was going to end.
Fascinating.
And I wanted it to. Like, yeah. I was like, and it took my breath away. I couldn't breathe. It felt like, you know, like if you get hit in the back and you can't breathe for a second, what it felt like. And it was, it was horrible. Like, I'd never heard of it before. So I didn't know what was going on at all.
And the Zoloft helped?
Yes, okay. Completely flipped everything around.
Do you think you also had a postpartum depression?
I think so, yes. Okay. They didn't say that I had it, but I just...
Is that usual? Looking
at my mindset now compared to, you know, 6 months ago, complete different... Yeah.
All right. Well, great. So, good. Well done. You got biological problem, biological treatment, and it's very striking when the treatments work. and now the Zoloft what?
So I'm still breastfeeding, and I'm coming towards the end of the prescription of the Zoloft, and I don't have insurance, so I can't really afford to go find a doctor, see if they'll prescribe it for me again if I really need it. But I will do it if I'm going to have like some super adverse, you know, reaction.
Okay,
hold on. Getting off.
So hold on. So it's a little complicated. So you need a prescription more than the money to pay for the medicine, right?
Right.
Well, how old's the baby?
He's 9.5 months.
Don't you think if she were to call her doctor and say, I need a refill,
get a refill? I was confused on that too. So it's that the doctor won't give you another prescription for it?
Yep. So the prescription that I got was from the OB doctor.
Okay. Moved on.
Call back to the OB. Call back and say, I need a refill.
Yeah.
You don't have to see them. Go get a refill, and then when you go, get the generic, and shouldn't be very expensive at all.
Right. Yeah, I would call your OB.
Call your OB.
They,
Please do that.
They told me, okay, I'll try it. They told me, though, they were like, from here, you need to go find a regular doctor, and they'll continue a script for the Zoloft if you need it.
Well, I think you have to make an appeal on a compassionate basis for them to please.
Okay.
Yeah, after 12 months, I mean, you should at minimum be on it for 12 months,
okay.
in my humble opinion. Or some doctors should make that determination of how long. You are at a high risk of a relapse of depression, right? You're at higher risk than average. And you've said you've got the genetic heritage. Now you've had this.
So
depression, you know, you're the kind of person that you really want to be followed very, very carefully. And Zoloft can have a little withdrawal syndrome. It's not like a it's not like a Valium withdrawal or an alcohol withdrawal. It's kind of a weird buzzing and electrical feeling in your head and neck, and it can be very unpleasant. It's not everyone that gets it, but when they do, it's unpleasant. So you want to taper down if you're going to stop. Right. So that needs to be kind of managed too. Okay?
Well, and also the concern is that if it's been associated for you with this breastfeeding and
you're
still
breastfeeding
then don't get off of it.
Yeah, it's going to keep happening. There's no reason it wouldn't.
Okay. That was, I didn't know if that was going to be, if that was a, you know, possibility as well, because I'm still breastfeeding and I don't want to, I don't want to go back to that.
We would both predict that the postpartum would be at high risk of occurrence and the breastfeeding, what you call it, I forget the acronym, DEMER?
DEMER,
the DEMER will recur. I would predict very strongly that would be a likely thing.
Okay. All right. That's what I need to know.
Great question. Thanks, Angie. Good luck.
Yep. Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks.
See, that's an interesting question.
Mm-hmm.
And you were a psychology major in college. Do you do much of that kind of stuff with your patients?
I think as an OB, you're kind of always doing psychology.
Right. And so I was going to ask you is domestic violence, is that something you're having to contend with now?
Of course. We see it all the time. Yeah. And it's especially in pregnancy, unfortunately, that's when women become higher risk for it.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people don't realize that, but women become vulnerable when they're pregnant. And unfortunately, people that are abusers and attackers know that, and their risk goes up. So it's something you really got to look out for.
Do you have a sort of protocol for intervening, or a level at which you intervene aggressively?
Well, I mean, if you start to see signs, obviously you start to ask questions, and then you go through the appropriate channels, a social work or where we can refer the patient and things that we need to do. If it's in the hospital setting and there's some threat at all of any sort of abuse, then we even call security
and then
go from there.
And certain social services get involved.
Exactly.
And the idea is to separate them, separate.
Exactly.
That's intervention number one, two, and three. Has the Me Too movement at all affected? Do gynecology have an opinion about this? Are they getting involved with it? Because it's got to be changing interpersonal health, sexual health, that kind of thing.
I think, I was going to say, when you first said it, I was thinking as a physician, I was like, do you mean as a female doctor, as a gynecologist?
Well, I mean all of that. All of it, please.
I've actually seen a lot of rise in that. I don't know if you've seen, there's been a lot of articles now where like people in the medical profession are saying, hey, we're Me Too people. Also, we've been treated unfairly in certain ways. I personally haven't had any experiences like that. I've been fortunate where I don't feel like I'm someone who's been had prejudice against as a female necessarily.
I've never even seen that.
I haven't seen it, but it's out there. I'm sure it's out there.
Yeah.
Even, it's in any sort of...
I remember
of...
being rough when I was a chief resident, being very, very rough, and the women would react more strongly to me when I was being what I thought was a good teacher.
Well, I was going to say anytime there's a hierarchy of any kind, which medicine has a very clear hierarchy for people that don't know, in training.
It's like a military system.
It's like a military system. So anytime there's that, there's going to be different power levels, and obviously that could come into play.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I didn't have any personal experience with it. So
We're too busy to get
and I'm like, maybe I didn't. I didn't notice because I didn't care. I had to go to sleep.
Yeah,
but.
Right. It's the busy. It makes it impossible. Yeah.
But I know it's out there. And in terms of patients, I haven't necessarily been seeing anything more.
I just think that how women and men navigate is going to change. I'm not quite sure what it's going to be, but I feel like it's going in a healthier direction. That women aren't – there's a little bit of a Stockholm syndrome going on for a while where women were signed on to being like a 17-year-old male or equal. And now we're saying, nah, it didn't work for me. I'm pissed. Why?
Right.
And that didn't work out. And let me just start to pay attention to my own instinctive experiences rather than sublimating them.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
I think it's going to just – I don't know. It's going to change. I think that's a good thing. That's a piece of this Me Too, sir. We haven't really – heard about in the press. And I just think there's going to be a social change.
There's definitely going to be a social change. And I think people are going to just start speaking out more in all different types of prejudices and abuse. And I'm sure that will play a role as patients come and talk to their doctors about some of these things.
Any culturally sensitive issues you've had to deal with? Is there anything, again, I'm just thinking about challenges as a gynecologist. Are there anything weird that you've had to pay attention to as our world becomes smaller and smaller? No. I mean, the female genital mutilation, is that something you come up
with? Oh, yeah. I don't see it as much anymore. But when I was a resident, like I said, I actually trained out in D.C., and I saw a lot of it,
And it's a whole lot of different things, right?
Yeah, there's different categories, different stages to it. And what was really unfortunate is these women would come, they would have had female circumcision, which a lot of times their labia is completely sewn together. There's not much of an introitus, which is, for those listening, the hole into your vagina, and they would need to have a baby. And after, you know, they have a baby, obviously that's going to be torn, and they would want us to repair it.
Put it back?
Yeah. So that would put us at a very, an ethical dilemma, because to them, culturally, it's important to have it closed like that.
Oh, my God.
That's the way that they were raised. They're coming from different, countries in Africa. So they would want us to put things back together that way. And we would just have to say no as Americans and as physicians, we don't think that's what's best for you. So that was really interesting to see how someone could have something done to them that is really physical abuse and trauma, and then want it to be corrected.
I think women women have a higher, when you look at them psychologically on the sort of personality characteristics, they're higher in the agreeableness scale. They're more cooperative. They're more likely to feel responsible if something goes wrong. That's just fact. And I think that makes them more likely to sort of, I don't know how else to say this, is be a participant in a Stockholm syndrome type situation. They get themselves into thinking that's just the way it is. And if I have a problem with it, the problem is me, not the practice. Mm-hmm. And that breaks my heart when women do that. That's what I think has been happening in the interpersonal sphere too, which is why the Me Too, I think, is a breakout from that. You know, as women breaking away from that kind of Stockholm thinking, which I think is great. Do you agree with me?
I definitely agree with you. I think there's so much truth in that. Even, in situations that aren't harmful, women tend to be more agreeable. And a lot of times that's a positive thing, because they're easier to get along with. They have more friends. They're more social. And that's the great part of being agreeable. But like you're saying, it also lends to them being hurt, taken advantage of, manipulated.
I really think it's like being like in a domestic violence situation. Mm-hmm. That to me is a cult of two, where the woman is taking on the Stockholm syndrome of the abuser. And the same thing in the other side of this too is in the workplace. If they're trying to make a go in some big corporate structure, agreeableness may not work so well. They've got to be disagreeable a lot of the time. But we need to support women in being that way if that's what they want to do.
Well, and a lot of that is society, right? Society,
No, it turns out it's not. It turns out it's something about your double X chromosome.
I think if we can change the way that we look as a society.
It doesn't really matter. It just should be changed, right?
Exactly.
But there clearly are these persistent in all societies across all spectrum, the same change that this agreeableness scale is there everywhere in all societies under all circumstances.
Right.
So that's biology then, right?
Or there's this commonality amongst all societies that
Do you have children?
No.
Okay.
You're like, wait till you have a girl and a boy.
Yes. You can spend your entire day trying to work on whatever is innate in their biology, and you will not change it. You will not change it. Because we had triplets, so we had boys and girls all at once, and we worked hard at trying to make everybody the same. No way. No way. I mean, from the second they came out of the womb. We had at age one, we took them to a toy store. My daughter goes to the boas and the sparkly stuff. My boys went to the hammers and the trains, and we couldn't pull one to the other.
Right.
I totally agree with that. So
there's
lots of stuff like that you see when you're raising kids.
Right.
That is just like, that is definitely in them.
Right. No, and I agree. There's obviously like feminine and masculine traits. And I don't think everyone's the same. There's a reason why there are different sexes. I'm just wondering if those qualities are ones that you're born with, or are those the agreeableness, the more likely to be abused, those kind of things are more societal based. I guess
the more likely to be abused, that's societal based, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That's for sure. But the agreeableness seems to be across everything. And listen, just because you have a certain, like we said, just because there's a proclivity, first of all, I think we got to be very honest and very clear about it if it's there. there and then mm-hmm. fight against it, to compensate for it, to raise women. That's what society can do, is to deal with the biology in a proactive way.
Right. I mean, we can say women are more agreeable, but that doesn't mean that we have to take advantage of their agreeableness.
No, it means that we have a choice. Either businesses need to be more agreeable in terms of how they run their hierarchy, or we need to coach women up to be more disagreeable in situations where they want to assert themselves.
Yes. Yeah.
One or the other. Yeah. That's what society can do. Let's see, taking some calls here. This is Will, you there?
Hi, man.
Will in Minneapolis.
Oh, hello.
Hey there.
Hey, how's it going?
What's up?
Sorry. I was just calling about a problem I'm having. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
Situation I'm dealing with is a evil stepmom type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
My dad and mom got divorced about a year ago. I'm 29, so I'm like, full grown adult, got my own life going and everything. But my dad started dating this new woman, and there was kind of problems right away. And just little things, she would kind of make comments a lot right off the bat, but then that kind of all came to a head when my dad hosted his annual Final Four party about a year ago, NCAA basketball tournament and whatnot.
Well, I'm wondering what your question is. How can we help?
Oh, sorry. I'm just getting set up here.
What's the question?
Basically, brought my dog to the party of the house I grew up in, and she kind of like put the foot down and kicked me out of my own house that I grew up in, and it's been really strained ever since. So it's just I don't know. It's kind of a long story short. I can give more details if you need. But
you're not living at home.
No. I live in Minneapolis, about an hour away from where my dad lives.
You and your dad go hang out and see what's going on in his head?
Oh, I did. And he's very, very passive. He's just kind of like cedes to her at all times.
What did he say when you said, "I'm upset, I've been kicked out of my own house, this is not even my own mom"? What did he say?
He was like, "Yeah, you're right, but... I'm kind of sorry. I don't know. I messed up." So then hasn't really done anything to rectify.
He said, "I messed up."
Yeah, like I should have taken your side. I should have stuck up for you.
Oh, he thinks you're just talking about that one situation. You need to tell him generally you're unhappy and you need to just, you need his support.
And yeah, I did that.
And
still kind of just, he's not really able to, he's kind of saying like, "Yeah, you're right. But doesn't really ever do anything about it.
Any suggestions?
Have you talked to her? What's her reasoning for kicking you out?
Well, we did kind of have one sit down, the three of us. At one point, kind of tension grew so much that we had to talk it out. And she just is, it's like a kind of an after-school special cookie cutter, just evil, like kind of, I can't even like describe what she was doing.
Let me assure you are not describing it. So we don't understand what you're talking about.
Sorry. She's just kind of like, I can't believe you would bring, your dog to someone else's house without asking. You're being abusive to your father by making him choose between me and you. Yada, yada, yada.
She's not wrong.
So it's centered around the dog.
Yeah.
Well, in that situation, yeah.
What do you do for a living?
I'm a substitute teacher.
Okay. My prediction is, and I I'm just guessing, is that this is going to kind of blow over. That's my prediction. If you're going to be an adult here and not a passive child who is worrying about his mommy and his house of origin, which is not his, it's theirs. It is not your house. Even though you grew up there, it is not yours. And let's be an adult here. You teach kids. You want to be a role model to other people. Be an adult. Keep hashing it out with everybody. Do what you need to do to be a good son, even though realizing you will not get a great relationship with your stepmom, it sounds like. That's the way it goes. He married someone who's not going to be very, very particularly a great stepmom to you. You can still be a good son because that's the right thing to do. How's that sound?
I think that sounds good. Yeah. And I was also going to say just, it is like Dr. Drew said, it is their home. So if they have certain rules, maybe one rule is not bring the pet in the home. You have to respect that rule.
And by the way, if you still have a room at that house, don't take it down. Dismantle it and take it all into your house and form a family of your own and a life of your own. Don't worry about him so much. Christine, go ahead.
Hi.
Hey there.
Hi. I was actually wondering, and I came in part way, so I'm thinking that there's a hospitalist on with us as well.
It's an OBGYN hospitalist.
Okay, sorry. Yeah. Okay, so.
That's okay.
My cousin, he's an alcoholic. Mm-hmm. He is dying of cirrhosis. He has less than 10% liver function. Mm-hmm. He's 38 years old. Mm-hmm. He drank and had a 0.427 blood alcohol level.
Good times.
I know. I got him out of the car. I got him to the hospital. I stayed with him there about 14 hours until I had to go home. And they waited, of course, for him to speak to someone till his blood alcohol level went down. And by that time, I mean, he was violent, abusive, talking about how he couldn't wait to die by the end of the night. And there was police there and everything. And they let him go home.
Oh, my God.
When he sobered up.
That's crazy.
And I'm just curious. That was his third visit. And I was the third
Let me just say, Christine, this is why we have homelessness. This is why we have the guy shooting up Florida. Because there's an intermediate zone where mental health professionals and doctors can't do anything. We can't force people to get care if they don't want it. You're cousin needs to go to a psychiatric hospital. I think an enlightened psychiatrist would put him on a hold. Maybe if he sobers up enough, they can get through to him, get him sober, and get a liver transplant. And let's get this thing going. That's not an ER. You got to get him to a psychiatric hospital.
To an actual psych. See, that's what we were hoping they would do at that point.
Yeah, they, for whatever reason.
Get him anywhere.
Yeah, somehow he said the right things not to be holdable.
Right, that's the thing is a psychiatric hold can only occur if you're immediate harm to yourself or others. If he had sobered up and he, you know, denied suicide or wanted
to. Yeah, I want to get out of here. Yeah. You guys are a bunch of assholes. You can't help keep me. I know my rights. That's right. They can't. And but anybody who deals with alcoholics knows that's alcoholic bullshit and they will bring him in and try to get him where his brain is working right. So, all right.
Yeah, because last weekend he literally crashed his car and was pulled over by a tow truck. He was driving on just rims and a shattered windshield.
Yeah,
I'm at my wit's end.
There's a program called Al-Anon you may want to hang out at a little bit that helps people who are dealing with alcoholics, family members, loved ones, because it's not a battle you can fight by yourself. As I always tell everybody, you ever seen The Little Shop of Horrors?
Yeah.
Yeah, the plant, the Audrey 2, is a perfect model for alcoholism, which is if you go near it, you go in the plant, unless you have somebody there pulling you out. You're part of the disease when you're around it. It eats you up, even though nobody's consciously engaging. It's just the nature of the condition. Okay?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
I'm sorry, too.
Thanks. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to get emotional.
Well, it's an emotional thing. You're in the vortex, and it sucks you up, and it's very painful. It's hard to see people dying of a disease that you know is caused by an external substance. It's really hard.
Yeah, it's unreal. Well, I appreciate you both very, very much.
All right, Christine.
You're welcome.
Check it out.
Thank you.
Maybe get him to a meeting. Maybe you can pull him. I don't want you doing that necessarily because that won't work. But get him around a meeting, get somebody who's in recovery to reach out warm hand to him, a nice warm handshake, and see if they can pull him into the program. Drugs you're seeing on the hospital? Opiates mostly, benzos.
Yeah, I'm in the valley. We see a lot of meth.
Meth. Yeah, meth is back.
Meth is back. Very, very, very.
Yeah,
bad.
It's back, and it's bad with opiates, which because they're so paranoid and agitated, it's impossible to treat them for the drug addiction.
Yeah, it's awful. And you know what always surprises me, and you know you're an expert on addiction, you know, but it's the people that come in you just don't expect it. A lot of times, we're seeing these people that are just working, and someone says, "Hey, at work, if you want to stay up and do that extra shift, have a hit of this," and the next thing they know, they're addicted to meth.
That's kind of how it happens.
That's a big abbreviated
story.
Version.
Yeah, that's their story.
Of course, there's
usually they were smoking pot and drinking and kind of on the way already.
Of course, and there's psychological factors and family factors and all of that. I'm just saying that.
But you're right. You could be a truck driver. You could be a factory worker.
Exactly.
And that's why I tell people, they go, "What triggers addiction? Sometimes bad luck. Sometimes you're a truck driver and somebody hands you meth, and it works, and you're sort of inclined that way, and off you go."
Mm-hmm.
And I'm interested that are they smoking it? Are they
smoking it?
Oh my God! A lot of the homeless people is meth and heroin right now.
Right.
And the cops were telling me, they go, "How come everywhere they're taking apart bicycles? Like it's meth. You take apart your TV, you take apart your radio. That's just what meth does to your brain. We don't know why. They're looking for something inside that's talking to them, or who knows what the paranoia is. They don't know half the time. So
It's scary stuff.
Were you able to refer them out, or will they take treatment? Is there treatment available? Or?
You know, it's, again, the hospital system. It's so in and out. You give them the resources, but you can't make someone do something they don't want to do.
Yeah.
So
by way of wrapping up, what else do you want to get people to know? What things do we not cover that you want people to be sure to be aware of, to be thinking about, to be educated about? I mean, obviously the HPV vaccine.
Yeah.
We're both on that. Emergency contraceptives.
Yes.
I'm a big fan of that. If you're not on some – and by the way, if you're using emergency contraceptives repeatedly, that means you need to see your gynecologist.
I always say it's plan B for a reason, because you need plan A.
Yeah. You get plan A in place. And anything about new contraceptives or anything people should look forward to or things that are out there that –
I'm always, like I said, I'm always a big proponent of longer term stuff. Talk to your doctor about longer term contraceptive, especially if you're young and you're active, then you're going to have, implants, mm-hmm. IUDs, like something that's there that you don't have to think about so that you're not having to go get the plan B.
Favorite IUDs?
It depends on the person. It's so multifactorial. It depends on a person's lifestyle and what their needs are. That's why it's important to talk to your doctor about all your options. And something that I always say is, what worked for you in high school may be different for you in college, later in life, after you've had babies. So birth control is something you always want to revisit. Talk about what your life plans and goals are and see what works best for you.
And just be aware of progesterone's protean effects. I've even seen systemic effects from the Mirena. Is that what it's called?
Mirena.
The Mirena is what a progesterone impregnated IUD. Are we ever going to see a male birth control pill? I know that's more of a urological issue.
Yeah, it's not my forte, but I am keeping up with it. And there's some great stuff that they're looking at. And hopefully that will be something that happens.
What are they doing? Paralyzing the sperm mostly? Or are they actually
There's the paralyzing the sperm. And then there's one that works more on male hormones. But
really?
Then that becomes kind of an issue.
Yeah.
There's a progesterone one. So it's interesting. It's interesting stuff.
We're going to start to see a lot.
It'd be cool, though, I think, for someone else to take the responsibility.
Propecia-like stuff? Is that one of the things they're kind of looking
at?
Yeah.
Like kind of like an anti-testosterone thing.
All right. Well, listen, I really appreciate you being here. I haven't talked to a gynecologist in a long time. And I appreciate the willingness to sort of go across all this wide landscape with us. We do appreciate it.
Thank you. Yeah.
And people can find you again, Twitter at Perry underscore MD, at Dr. Perry, DOCTOR, and Dr. again spelled out Perry, PARI.com is the website. What can they find at the website?
Lots of GYN, women's health facts, lots of commonly asked questions, periods, birth control, pregnancy stuff, kind of anything you want to know.
Periods and birth control, all that good stuff. All right, you guys, thank you so much, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks.
For call-in times and topics, follow the show on Twitter at Dr. Drew Podcast. That's D-R-D-R-E-W Podcast. The music from today's episode can be found on the swinging sounds of the Dr. Drew Podcast, now available on iTunes. And while you're there, don't forget to rate the show. The Dr. Drew Podcast is a Corolla Digital production and is produced by Chris Loxamana and Gary Smith. For more information, go to drdrew.com. All conversation and information exchanged during the participation in the Dr. Drew Podcast is intended for educational and entertainment purposes only. Do not confuse this with treatment or medical advice or direction. Nothing on these podcasts supplement or supersede the relationship and direction of your medical caretakers. Although Dr. Drew is a licensed physician with specialty board certifications by the American Board of Internal Medicine and the American Board of Addiction Medicine, he is not functioning as a physician in this environment. The same applies to any professionals who may appear on the podcast or drdrew.com.